Hello, undisclosed listeners, and welcome to the final episode of Collins' four-part arc on the State v. Jamar Huggins. We've got four great sponsors for you this week, and they include ZipRecruiter, Time, the Khalif Browder story, premiering this Wednesday, March 1st at 10 p.m., only on Spike, Blue Apron, and Stamps.com. Make sure you listen in for those spots later in the show and support our sponsors because they support us. Until then, enjoy the program.
Franz Kafka's 1925 novel, The Trial, tells the story of Joseph K., who is arrested by unidentified agents from an unnamed agency for an unspecified crime. My favorite part of the novel is the parable before the law, told to Joseph K. by a prison chaplain. Here's Orson Welles narrating the parable in his 1962 film adaptation of Kafka's work.
Before the law, there stands a god. A man comes from the country, begging admittance to the law. But the god cannot admit him. Can he hope to enter at a later time? That is possible, says the god. The man tries to peer through the entrance. He had been taught that the law should be accessible to every man. Do not attempt to enter without my permission, says the god. I am very powerful, yet I am the least of all the gods. From hall to hall, door after door, each god is more powerful than the last.
The man from the country complies and waits. He waits for years. He gives everything he has to the guard, who tells him, I take what you give me, only so you will not feel that you have left something undone. As he grows old, the man perceives a radiance streaming immortally from the door of the law. And before he dies, all of his experiences condense into one question.
How is it then that in all these years, no one else has ever come here seeking admittance? His hearing has failed, so the guard yells into his ear, no one else but you could ever have obtained admittance. No one else could enter this door. This door was intended only for you. And now, I am going to close it.
Since its publication, Before the Law has been appropriated not only by other artists like Martin Scorsese in the movie After Hours, but also by those in the legal system. Usually the parable is cited as a clear legal precedent that denies a party relief, as in Ellis v. Ellis, where an appellate court in Florida noted that a prior case had become Kafka's doorkeeper in regard to a fairness analysis in determining alimony payments. But a brief by a man named Tom Ellis to the Supreme Court of Alaska better captures the meaning of the parable. He wrote that, quote, a situation where a person initially believes that the law is an understandable system which applies to everyone, but then learns that the law is nothing more than a dialogue between himself and a representative of the law, is quite literally Kafkaesque. It's this that's the heart of Kafka's parable. It speaks to the notion of the legal mirage, a clear light at the end of the tunnel for the wrongfully convicted that seems so easy to reach and yet in the end turns out to be illusory and unattainable. And there's no better example of a legal mirage than a key witness recanting. Hi, this is Colin Miller. I'm an associate dean and professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and I blog at Evidence Prof Blog. In episode 3, I discussed how D'Angelo Montgomery, the only real witness against Jamar Huggins at his burglary trial, recanted her prior statement and denied that Jamar Huggins was involved in the home invasion on Memory Lane. This led the defense to move for a directed verdict, a motion that the judge reluctantly denied. Defense counsel John Long thought this was the wrong decision.
The fact is, she testified during trial that my client was not involved, and there was no evidence to implicate my client on the record. So I thought that direct verdict was proper at that time.
After this denial, Long made an important decision to change his trial strategy. He had a few witnesses lined up to testify for the defense, but didn't end up calling any of them. I asked him whether it was Montgomery's recantation that led to this change in direction.
That's right, because at the end of the day, you had no one was able to testify that my client was involved in the crime. So that's why I did not believe that it would be beneficial to call further witnesses who could only mess it up, so to speak, who could only muddy the waters of the testimony that was very strong in our favor. So that's why I made the strategic decision to not call any other witnesses.
And so, without any evidence or witnesses presented by the defense, the case proceeded to closing arguments on the morning of September 17th, 2014. Prosecutor Donna Elder mainly tried to spackle over the hole that had been created in her case. She argued, quote, "Now, D'Angelo only became hesitant when she walked into the courtroom. The only thing she was hesitant about was identifying the man that sat in front of her. She talked to detectives in January of 2013. The only problem she had was coming in here and telling you what she told the detectives." At this point, Long objected that this was speculation, and Judge Culbertson sustained the objection. Long's thinking might have been similar to the thinking of Paul George, the attorney from last episode, who is trying to appeal the similar Michael Rudd case, where the only witness against the defendant also recanted at trial.
One of the things that I fear the most in this situation is that a jury, seeing witness up on the witness stand shilly-shallying and non-credibly denied, made that prior statement, which is what happened in they think, they draw the conclusion, in the absence of any evidence of it, that, you know, the defendant has intimidated this person out of telling the truth, right? That's the conclusion that I'm afraid that a jury inevitably draws, particularly a jury that, you know, doesn't come from the community that the defendant comes from.
But while you might imagine that the sustained objection would have shut down this line of argument, here's Elder trying it again right after the judge's ruling. Quote, "She had a problem on the stand with identifying the defendant, and think about why that would be the case, why it might be difficult for someone to come in and take the stand and sit across from a man and point the finger and say that's the man who would go into somebody's house at night with a gun and point it at a 12-year-old child, take $15 in cash, and go on like nothing ever happened. Why would that be difficult?" This time, there was no objection by the defense. Instead, in his closing argument, Long countered with a proverb from the Bible. Quote, "Now I looked this up. I found a proverb. Proverbs 20:17 says, 'What you get by dishonesty, you may enjoy like the finest food, but sooner or later it will be like a mouthful of sand.' Now when D'Angelo Montgomery and Detective Martin, when they used that dishonesty, they enjoyed it like a mouthful of the finest food. They said, 'Man, this dishonesty, this is going to get me what I want, and it's good.' But today, they got a mouthful of sand. So I just ask you, use your common sense. Remember what D'Angelo Montgomery said. Jamar Huggins did not do it. Remember what the victim said, Angela Eckler. She could not identify the person went into her house. Thank you for your cooperation and your time, and I thank you." The jury was sent to deliberate at 11:05 a.m. Thereafter, at 1:25 p.m., the jury submitted a single question to the judge. "Judge Culbertson, we want to know the first date the investigator Martin interviewed Ms. Montgomery." Based on input from the attorneys, Judge Culbertson informed the jurors that it was January 11th, 2013 at 9:41 a.m. when she made her first statement. And with that, the jury continued deliberating. Finally, they returned with a verdict at 3:14 p.m. that same day. On the count of first-degree burglary, guilty. On the count of kidnapping, guilty. On the count of armed robbery, guilty. Denedra Smith, Jamar's sister, had her faith in the criminal justice system destroyed by the verdict.
It was so heartbreaking because we just knew, like, when you know you're innocent, you don't feel like there's a threat. You don't feel like, okay, because you're looking at it like, they tell you you're innocent until you're proven guilty, and he was not proven guilty. So we were like, okay, there's no way they can just take that and run with it. But that's absolutely what they did. And from this, we found out that you're actually guilty until you're proven innocent.
Meanwhile, Jamar's grandmother, Willie Dean Whaley, couldn't understand how the jury could find her grandson guilty when Montgomery had testified that he wasn't involved.
Yeah, right. They said this was not him. That's what she told them. Standing there before the chairman, the judge, and all other people in the court. I don't know how in the world they made the decision to take him and lock him up. It hurt. It hurt. I'll never get over what happened. Knowing that he's not guilty of the crime.
Finally, Jamar's attorney, John Long, summed up his reaction to the verdict in one word before expounding upon the subject.
Shock. I mean, really, really just... When it came down to it, I guess it would depend. My comments would depend on who my audience was, but to the general public, I would say I was just shocked that a jury could come to it guilty, to a decision of guilty beyond a reasonable doubt, with the evidence that was presented to them, strictly the evidence that was presented to them. I don't think they could get there from the evidence that they had.
Are you hiring? Do you know where to post your job to find the best candidates? Posting your job in one place isn't enough to find quality candidates. If you want to find the perfect hire, you need to post your job at all the top job sites, and now you can. With ZipRecruiter.com, you can post your job to 200 plus job sites, including social media networks like Facebook and Twitter, all with a single click. Find candidates in any city or industry nationwide. Just post once and watch your qualified candidates roll into ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use interface. There's no juggling emails or calls to your office. You can quickly screen candidates, rate them, and hire the right person fast. Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by Fortune 100 companies and thousands of small and medium-sized businesses. And right now, my listeners can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free by going to ZipRecruiter.com/undisclosed. That's ZipRecruiter.com/undisclosed. One more time to try it for free, go to ZipRecruiter.com/undisclosed. After the verdict, Long made a motion for Judge Culbertson to exercise his discretion as the 13th juror. The 13th juror rule provides that a judge has the authority to set aside a verdict when he feels that justice has not been done, like a president vetoing a bill or a chair umpire overruling a line judge in tennis. Long's argument was simple. The only witness who had implicated Jamar in the crime stated under oath that he wasn't involved. The prosecutor's response was equally simple. Under current South Carolina law, any prior inconsistent statement can be used as substantive evidence of the defendant's guilt, even if it wasn't given under oath. Judge Culbertson denied the defense's motion, but he was again doubtful of his own ruling, acknowledging to defense counsel, quote, "It was a close call, and you may well prevail on that in appeal." Jamar's mother, Helen, is still angry about the decision.
But the judge knew that my son got railroaded. He knew, because he told my son, "You hurry up and go for your appeal."
Right.
And he could have came to 13th juror and stopped all this.
With the verdict standing, the case proceeded to sentencing. The defense presented two witnesses in mitigation to try to get a lighter sentence. The first witness was Jamar's grandmother, Willie Dean Willie. She provided testimony similar to her statements that I played in the last episode about Jamar caring for her day and night. According to Willie, quote, "He takes care of me, and I need him. His room is right across the hall from me, and every time I pass out, I may pass out standing here now, and every time I pass out, he was there for me to call to get help. I need Jamar, and Jamar is not a street boy." The second witness was Jamar himself. He denied having any involvement in the crime and made the following plea to Judge Culbertson. "I did nothing wrong, Your Honor. All I ask, please, if it's anything you can do, something where I know you're going to give me something, but I'm saying if it's something, if I can be on house arrest at my grandma's house, doing time like that, staying at the house with her, I will be fine, no problem. If I can't even leave out the door, I wouldn't care as long as I'm there to take care of that woman. That's it." The prosecution didn't call any witnesses in aggravation, but the prosecutor did read the victim impact statement of Eckler's daughter into evidence. It was the statement I read toward the end of episode 1. Finally, defense counsel argued that Judge Culbertson should impose a light sentence based upon the weakness of the evidence against Jamar. The prosecutor responded that a sentence is not based on the weight of the evidence and that Judge Culbertson should consider going above the mandatory minimums because of how the perpetrator of this crime terrorized Echler and her daughter. Now, while the prosecutor was technically right, it certainly seems as if Judge Culbertson did consider the paucity of evidence against Jamar in his sentencing. 15 years for first-degree burglary, 15 years for kidnapping, 10 years for armed robbery, all the mandatory minimums. Just as importantly, Judge Culbertson ran the sentences concurrently as opposed to consecutively. Now, if the judge had run them consecutively, Jamar would have served a 15-year sentence, followed by another 15-year sentence, followed by the 10-year sentence, for a total of 40 years in prison. But with the sentences being concurrent, the sentences run parallel to one another, meaning that Jamar serves them all at the same time. So Jamar won't serve more than a total of 15 years, and he's eligible for parole after serving 85% of this 15-year sentence. Although the 12 jurors convicted Jamar in this case, if the circumstances had been slightly different, Jamar might have served no time at all because of a variation on the 13th juror rule. My attempts in reaching out to the jurors in the Jamar Huggins case were unsuccessful, but reporter Isaac Bailey was able to talk to two jurors when reporting on the case in 2015. One of these jurors was a man named Delbert, the only African-American juror in the case. As Bailey reported, there were very few African-Americans in the jury pool, and one, a young African-American woman, was dismissed after telling Judge Culbertson there's, quote, too much street in this case, while visibly shaking. According to Delbert, the one African-American juror who was impaneled, quote, the jury did not take the testimony of the prosecution's star witness seriously because we didn't know if she was drunk or high that day. Of course, the implication from this is that the jurors must have taken her prior police statement seriously, despite Montgomery admitting to using crack at the time of the crime. But Delbert never explained himself further. According to Bailey, he didn't respond to follow-up queries. The other juror who spoke to Bailey wasn't a deliberating juror. He was the alternate, or 13th juror, who would have replaced one of the 12 jurors if they had to exit the trial due to illness, misconduct, or some other emergency. This 13th juror, Mark, told Bailey that he would have voted to acquit Jamar, saying, quote, I was surprised by the verdict. I just didn't find the witness was credible. I thought there was a lack of evidence. I think Huggins may do stuff, but nothing proved he did that. Of course, it's impossible to say what Mark would have done in the face of 11 other jurors wanting to find Jamar guilty, but there's at least a decent chance that, with Mark as a juror, Jamar could have gotten a hung jury and a prosecutor who was unlikely to bring the case to trial again after Montgomery's about-face in the witness stand. But instead of being a free man, Jamar was convicted. On July 26, 2015, he brought his direct appeal based upon errors evident from the trial record. On this appeal, he was represented by Robert Patchek, a pro bono appellate defender at the South Carolina Commission on Indigent Defense. Patchek said he couldn't comment on the appeal, but he sent me a copy of his appellate brief. It raised one issue, that Judge Culbertson should have granted trial counsel's motion for a directed verdict. According to the brief, the only witness to attempt to identify Jamar as the suspect was Montgomery, who is a crack addict who had little memory of the evening of December 20th. She was currently incarcerated on two counts of armed robbery. She said she could not remember anything. She said Jamar did not look like one of the suspects. She said he was not the same person. Patchek next addressed the legal standard. According to the brief, a motion for a directed verdict should be granted, quote, where evidence merely raises a suspicion of guilt or is such to permit the jury to merely conjecture or to speculate as to the accused's guilt. Patchek's argument was that Montgomery's recantation at trial meant that the jury could be left with nothing more than a suspicion of guilt. But this takes us back to the 1982 change in South Carolina law. As I've noted, based on this 1982 change, Montgomery's prior police statement was considered substantive evidence of Jamar's guilt, which is why the Court of Appeals of South Carolina denied Jamar relief, with the Supreme Court of South Carolina later following suit on March 30th, 2016. But it feels to me like an argument was left on the table. The only portion of Montgomery's police interview that was admitted into evidence at trial was the part where she said that Junk was the man with the mask and the gun. The separate part where she identified Jamar as Junk was deemed inadmissible, and Judge Culbertson himself recognized there was no evidence in the trial record that Jamar was in fact Junk. Given this, I think there's a great argument that the evidence at Jamar's trial merely created the suspicion of guilt because the jury could only speculate that Jamar was Junk. But that argument was never made. Apron is the number one fresh ingredient and recipe delivery service in the country. Blue Apron has established partnerships with over 150 local farms, fisheries, and ranchers all across the U.S. As a result, their seafood is sourced sustainably under standards developed in partnership with the Monterey Bay Aquarium Seafood Watch, and their produce is sourced from farms that practice regenerative farming. Now, I know some of you have seen the images I've posted on social media of things I've cooked from Blue Apron, like the crispy barramundi and the butternut squash pasta with romaine and apple salad. And let me tell you, the meals taste as good as they look, and they're so easy to prepare. And that's because each meal comes with a step-by-step, easy-to-follow recipe card and pre-portioned ingredients, and can be prepared in 40 minutes or less. Plus, Blue Apron's freshness guarantee promises that every ingredient in your delivery arrives ready to cook, or they'll make it right. And so now, undisclosed listeners, you can check out this week's menu and get your first three meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/undisclosed. You'll love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron. So don't wait. That's blueapron.com/undisclosed. Blue Apron, a better way to cook. After this decision, Jamar's sisters decided to take matters into their own hands. Here's Jamar's sister Denedra describing the efforts that they've taken and the financial hardship it has caused the family.
We've done so many things since he's been locked up, and it's not cheap by any means. Like, these lawyers cost money. The activities, the walks, we've done marches, we've done fundraisers. Everything costs, and now, to get the PCR, we would have to hire a new lawyer just to separately handle that. And so that's what we're working on at the moment. It's just, it's been a lot on us, but we're willing to do whatever it takes to get him home.
PCR, or post-conviction relief, is a collateral appeal based upon errors not evident from the trial record. The most common claim in PCR is ineffective assistance of counsel. And there's a possible claim for Jamar that sounds very similar to a claim from the PCR hearing in the Adnan Syed case in our first season. According to Jamar's mother, Helen, she remembers the early morning hours of December 20th, which is when the home invasion on Memory Lane occurred. Helen says that her friend Jeanette Scott and she arrived home from a Conway bingo parlor and saw Jamar at home sleeping in bed. Here's what Helen told me when I recently talked to her.
Yeah, we got out of bingo early that night. We used to get out at 2, but we got out at 12. So I got home like 12:10. And when I got home, one of the girls from bingo came by the house. So I woke my son up. And he, you know, when you wake somebody, hey, Mom, you woke me up. I said, yeah. He said, I'm tired. So I told him, I said, okay then. So he smoked a cigarette. And he went back to bed. And I said, well, I have insomnia, so I don't sleep at night. So I sat up in the den and watched TV all night. So the boy didn't go nowhere. That's why I say, how can he be robbing somebody when he in the bed asleep?
So what time do you think that you arrived home that night?
12:10.
12:10, okay. And did his attorney ever talk to you?
No.
Helen's friend Jeanette said the same thing to reporter Isaac Bailey. According to his reporting, Jeanette told him, quote, we already knew that girl Montgomery was lying because we saw Jamar that night. Unfortunately, it's tough to say what's going on here. According to Bailey's reporting, it's not entirely clear why there was no communication between these potential alibi witnesses and Jamar's trial attorney. But Bailey notes the following, quote, because Detective Martin used police deception during his interrogation with Huggins, there was initial confusion about which night the home invasion took place, making it difficult to pin down a reliable alibi. All of which goes to say that this might or might not be a viable claim. Due to attorney-client privilege, Jamar's trial attorney, John Long, wasn't able to talk to me about the issue, but Jamar's sister, Denedra, told me that he has indicated he might be able to assist with an ineffective assistance claim.
You know, it's mostly John Long even himself said he made mistakes and he would be willing to help us with the PCR.
And indeed, when I talked to John Long himself about what lessons he learned from the trial, his answer implied that there were a few things he wished he had handled differently during that trial.
No matter how well you prepare for a trial,
no matter what direction you think that trial is going to go, always be prepared for the unexpected, and be able to counter the arguments that could come, that could arise when you don't expect them to arise. And it really caught me off guard when the co-defendant completely changed her story, and that changed the whole complexity and the focus of our case. And the opening statement that I presented to the jury would have been completely different had I known that his co-defendant was going to testify the way she did.
But that said, to prove ineffective assistance, it's not enough to say that defense counsel's performance could have been better. Instead, a defendant like Jamar needs to point to some identifiable error that was both unreasonable and undermines our confidence in the jury's verdict. It's possible that such an error exists, but a lot of that will depend on the communications between Jamar's new attorney and his old trial attorney. Overall, it's tough to say anything definitive because the whole PCR process is just starting for Jamar. That said, this isn't the only attack that Jamar is making on his conviction. Stamps.com saves you time and money, which you can use to grow your business. Stamps.com brings all of the services of the U.S. Postal Service right to your fingertips. You can buy and print official U.S. postage for any letter, any package, any class of mail using just your own computer and printer. Stamps.com makes it easy. They'll send you a digital scale, which automatically calculates exact postage, and they can even help you decide the best class of mail based on your needs. There's no need to lease an expensive postage meter. And best of all, unlike the post office, Stamps.com never closes. You can print postage for letters or packages at your convenience 24/7. I use Stamps.com because I'm working on cases in several jurisdictions, and it makes life so much easier and more convenient. And right now, you too can enjoy the stamp service with a special offer that includes a 4-week trial, plus postage, and a digital scale without long-term commitments. Just go to Stamps.com, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage, and type in undisclosed. That's Stamps.com, enter undisclosed. Stamps.com, never go to the post office again. Previously, the family hired Natasha Hanna to pursue a motion for a new trial, which is a completely separate avenue for relief. Hanna is a Myrtle Beach attorney and a 2002 graduate of the University of South Carolina School of Law. As Hanna told me, Jamar is lucky in a certain sense because he has a strong support system, and a lot of defendants in his position wouldn't be getting another look at their cases.
One of Jamar's sisters reached out to me and asked if I would take a look at Jamar's case, and I did that. And I got to tell you, his family and his sisters are some of the most supportive people that I have ever met. They believe in Jamar, and they truly believe he's innocent, and they're doing everything that they can in order to help facilitate a new trial or a turnover of his conviction.
As was likely the case for many of you, Hanna was surprised about the lack of evidence against Jamar. Specifically, she noted the following.
To me, two of the most troubling things about this case is, one, we have a man who has proclaimed his innocence since day one that was convicted on evidence that, to me, is frighteningly small. The only evidence that really links him to this crime is the testimony of an uncredible witness, someone who was inconsistent in her statement before trial and at trial, and who was completely unreliable based on her her other involvement in crime and based on her consistent use of crack cocaine. So you have an unreliable witness that put Jamar Huggins in prison for a very long time. And the second thing that bothers me the most is DeAngela Montgomery. She is somebody who definitely is guilty of a crime, but it also bothers me tremendously that even if you look at the facts as a whole, she is somebody who was manipulated during the interview process by the police and is the least culpable in committing this crime, and yet she is sitting in prison for 10 years.
After reviewing the file, Hanna decided that her best chance at getting Jamar relief was having a private investigator re-interview DeAngela Montgomery.
Well, we finally got our break this past fall. It was late in the fall. We had hired a private investigator to go and meet with D'Angelo Montgomery. And the sisters, Jamar's sisters, had suspected all along that she would eventually name the person that was actually with her the night of the crime. And our investigator was able to find out the name of the person who was actually with her, and it was not Jamar Huggins.
Specifically, the private investigator interviewed Montgomery twice. Here's the relevant portion of the signed statement that resulted from the first interview. This is a true statement from Miss D'Angela Shanta Montgomery provided to the private investigator, transcribed from field notes during interview. December. I was doing drugs at the time, taking crack cocaine and heroin. It is hard to remember exact date. It was myself and T. I called first. Jamar Huggins about using his car. Told me no. T called next. He told him yes. T did not tell Junk Jamar Huggins what was going on. Junk never knew what happened. T was driving and we picked up another guy. I can't say who the other guy was. We went straight to the house. I knocked on the door and asked for Drake. Drake was getting high with me. He prostituted me out. He was taking care of me. I did not know his girlfriend. We thought Drake would be there. The plan was not to go in the house, as we wanted to get Drake to ride with me. We were going to take him off and rob him. Drake had money. The girlfriend said Drake was in the mental hospital. I started to walk off, and they went inside. They came out with money and drugs with them as they came from the house. Jamar Huggins' junk was not present during the robbery. We only used his car to go see Drake. After they took money and drugs, we took the car that belonged to Junk back to his house, which was his grandmother's house. We never told Jamar about the robbery. Junk was sleeping. We gave him his keys and walked back to your house. About a few weeks later, police began looking for me. I had placed myself in detox. I turned myself into the police. The next day, the private investigator spoke to Montgomery again, which resulted in the PI writing out the following statement that Montgomery later signed. Interviewer spoke to D'Angelo Montgomery by phone. Miss Montgomery stated that T and Mr. K were the two guys with her on December 20th, 2012. Mr. K was wearing the mask during the robbery. Mr. K threatened her if she told anyone he was involved. She is afraid of Mr. K. He is known to commit violent crimes. Afraid that Mr. K would come after her and harm her or her family. She was reluctant to tell the police his name. Miss Montgomery did tell the police that T was with her, but he was never charged. This was the second recantation by Montgomery, and the second point in this case where you might imagine that Jamar's freedom was imminent. But this takes us back to the concept of a legal mirage from the parable before the law, and this one isn't limited to just South Carolina or only a handful of states. The assumption would be that a recantation by the only witness for the prosecution would be a get-out-of-jail-free card. But that assumption is wrong. In its 1955 opinion in State v. Whitener, the Supreme Court of South Carolina concluded that, quote, recantation of testimony ordinarily is unreliable and should be subjected to the closest scrutiny when offered as grounds for a new trial. It's a precedent that's still applied today, and most states have precedent with very similar language. And such language is a roadblock that has prevented any number of defendants from getting new trials despite recantations by the only witnesses against them. But is Montgomery's new recantation the type of recantation controlled by cases like Whitener? Jamar's attorney, Natasha Hanna, doesn't think so.
I believe it is sufficient to obtain a new trial. A lot of the case law in South Carolina states that recantation testimony is not enough for a new trial. But I believe this case is distinguishable simply because it's not a recantation. That's not the new evidence. The new evidence is the co-defendant has now named the actual person that was with her that night.
I agree with her on this point, and that's because the precedent on recantations is all about legal inertia. Courts are wary of allowing witnesses to recant testimony given under oath accusing the defendant of a crime. But in this case, Montgomery testified under oath that Jamar was not involved in the crime. Now, she did testify that a guy named Junk was involved, and her new statement recants that portion of her testimony by now claiming that Mr. K, who goes by a nickname but not the nickname Junk, was the one who was involved. But Montgomery is not seeking to invalidate testimony implicating Jamar in the crime. Does that make Jamar's case sufficiently different from the prior precedent that would deny him relief? Again, Hannah thinks so, but she's not 100% confident. And that's why, after filing for a new trial based on Montgomery's new statements, Hannah asked for a continuance to gather more evidence.
As an attorney, you're always concerned that you just don't have enough. And there are leads and avenues that I wanted to explore, and I've continued to do that. We have several new things that we are exploring to be able to give enough comfort to the judge that the wrong man really is in prison.
When Hannah has collected all of her evidence and the motion is eventually heard, the granting of a new trial will largely hinge on a single question. Would the newly discovered evidence probably change the result if a new trial was held? But it might never get to that point. Jimmy Richardson is the prosecutor, what we here in South Carolina call the solicitor who's currently on the case, and he's been made aware of the new evidence.
The solicitor has been made aware of Ms. Montgomery's identification of the person who was actually with her that night. And although he has not indicated that he has a formal position on Jamar's case, I truly believe that in Horry County, we have a solicitor, Solicitor Richardson, who is a good guy, he's a fair guy, and he's an honest guy, which to me equates to being someone who wants justice, even if that means overturning a wrongful conviction or granting a new trial. I truly believe that Solicitor Richardson wants that.
Indeed, in answering a question about the effect that being convicted has had in Jamar, his sister Denager told me there's actually a connection between her brother and Jimmy Richardson.
Jamar knows a lot of people. Like, he's very known around the community. Like, people just know him as a fun guy. He's very involved in his kids' after-school activities as well as school. So he knows a lot of people. Like, he even used to help coach on the same team as Jimmy Richardson, and, you know, their sons played on the same football team. Like, he knows so many different people, and he did lose people at an early age, and he's still losing people even while he's locked up, and that's affecting him.
And Jamar's conviction hasn't just worn on him as he spends day after day in a prison cell wondering if and when he'll ever get out. His sisters are out there every day trying to make and raise money to try to prove his innocence. Isaac Bailey has reported that his children's grades and eating habits have suffered. And Jamar's grandmother, Willie Dean Whaley, feels his absence every day.
It hurt me so bad. Y'all don't know. Night and day, I can't sleep. I worry about my child. I helped to get him from a baby. And he loved me, and I love him. He took care of me. He was there for me. I can't help it.
Soon after Jamar's conviction, Jamar's mother Helen needed to start taking medication, and
right now, it still got an impact on me because I have nightmares about this thing because I know he didn't do it.
On March 1st at 10 p.m. on Spike, from executive producers Sean Jay-Z Carter and Harvey Weinstein, comes the groundbreaking six-part documentary event series, Time, the Kalief Browder Story. Browder was a 16-year-old African-American high school student from the Bronx, walking home from a party when he was arrested for allegedly stealing a backpack. He then spent an unthinkable 3 years in Rikers Island, with 2 of those years in solitary confinement, all without ever being convicted of a crime. The series uses first-person accounts, unprecedented archival footage, and interviews with politicians, friends, and family, all to take a comprehensive look at Kalief's life and how his legacy shines a light on the inequalities inside the criminal justice system. According to Jay-Z, Kalief Browder is a modern-day prophet, his story a failure of the judicial process. Time recently premiered at the Sundance Film Festival, where it had a profound impact on audience members. Variety calls Time an important contribution to the true crime documentary genre, and what sets it apart is that you can see many of the violations of Browder and other young men happening right before your eyes inside Rikers. The Daily Beast says it's the best documentary coming out of Sundance and maybe this year's OJ Made in America, and Revolt called it captivating. And I can say, having watched a few of the episodes, this is must-watch TV for undisclosed listeners or anyone interested in the criminal justice system. So that's Time, the Kalief Browder story, and it premieres March 1st at 10 p.m. on Spike. So what are my final thoughts on the case? It seems to me that Jamar is serving a 15-year prison sentence based on nothing more than letting a friend borrow his car one night and being unlucky to be prosecuted in one of the few states in the country where someone can be convicted based solely on the unsworn statement of a single witness that is later recanted at trial. In this case, the law of unintended consequences led to the perverse result of Jamar Huggins being convicted based upon a change to the law that was supposed to help secure the freedom of the innocent. But that's not the only havoc the law of unintended consequences has wreaked in this case. There's Angela Eckler and her daughter, failing to receive justice because neither of the two men who terrorized her have been punished. There's Jamar's family, who have lost a son, a grandson, a brother, and a father for a decade and a half. And while the change to South Carolina's evidence law in 1982 made it much easier to secure Jamar's conviction based on a recanted statement by the only witness against him, it still applies a law that makes appealing that same conviction based upon another recantation by that same witness exceedingly difficult. Franz Kafka's The Trial ends with Joseph K. suffering the same fate as the man from the country and before the law, never receiving justice, the light at the end of the tunnel being a legal mirage. And the same fate befalls far too many in our criminal justice system who have been wrongfully convicted. But the light in Jamar's case, once flickering, is now strong. It's strong because he has a family that has sacrificed their lives to free his. It's strong because a reporter was willing to devote a series of articles to his case. It's strong because he has an attorney who is willing to go the extra yard. And while this is the end of my series in the Jamar Huggins case, I can promise you, I'm not giving up in this case. I will continue reporting on it and trying to assist in whatever way I can, because this is a man who does not deserve to be in prison. Thanks for listening to this week's Undisclosed. Now that you've heard how close Jamar might be to proving his innocence and becoming a free man, you can really help his case by going to www.fundedjustice.com/JamarHuggins and contributing to his legal defense fund. Every dollar matters. I'd like to thank the following people: Zoe for her assistance in researching and writing this series, Rebecca Lavoy of Partners in Crime Media and the host of Crime Writers On and These Are Their Stories podcast for audio production, Christy Williams and Nina Musser for website management, Baluki for our logo, Patrick Cortez and Ramiro Marquez for our theme music, Mital Telhan, our executive producer. Some of the music you heard throughout this episode comes from Ward Dunn and his South Carolina band Pluto Wilson. You can get their music at plutowilson.bandcamp.com. The credits song is South Carolina bluesman Pink Anderson's public domain song, I'll Fly Away. And you can send me questions for this week's final undisclosed addendum for this arc by using the hashtag UDAddendum. And you can follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram by using the handle @UndisclosedPod. Oh, yes, I will fly away. Oh, when I die, hallelujah, bye bye. We'll fly away. Church members, ah.